from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Joy of Cooking, the classic American cookbook that's been called the Swiss Army Knife or Bible of Cooking. It's been fully revised to reflect the way we eat today, with new or updated vegan recipes, recipes for palak paneer, pozole, and kimchi jjigae. It also has a section on preventing food waste. The great-grandson of the book's original author and his spouse updated the book, and they're here to tell us what it took to test and revise its more than 4,000 recipes, all while honoring the book's legacy. Join us after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're joined now by the two people who took on the Herculean task of revising what's been called America's most popular cookbook, Joy of Cooking. The book has been around since 1931. It's reliable recipes for chocolate chip cookies or Cajun dirty rice. And its efforts to adapt to the times have helped Joy of Cooking find an enduring spot on kitchen shelves for nearly 90 years. Earlier versions had sections on war rationing and using new appliances like freezers and blenders. In the 70s, it added recipes for granola and yogurt. This version, you'll find kale salad, Thai-style wings, Guyanese pepper pot, lamb shawarma, and even samjang. John Becker and Megan Scott, welcome to Forum.
Thanks so much for having us.
And congratulations on completing a full revision of Joy of Cooking for 2019.
Thank you
so much. It's a relief to get it out there in the world.
Yes. I mean, this project had to have taken over your lives. So can you talk about how you approached testing the recipes and how long this took you?
What life?
Yeah.
No, there was no work-life balance at all.
We started testing recipes in 2010. We sort of did this initial apprenticeship with the book, and that started out by testing recipes from the previous edition, which came out in 2006. So we started testing recipes, and then we did what we call recipe genealogies, where we would test the recipe and then go back in older editions to find out where it had been added in the history of the book and to see also how it had changed over time. So we did that for about 4 years, and at that point we had tested over 1,500 recipes. And then we started thinking seriously about this new revision and went through the previous edition line by line and created a huge outline. Went through the book probably three times to create this outline to have a very detailed blueprint of what exactly we wanted to do with each section of each chapter, what recipes we felt were missing, which recipes we felt were outdated and needed to be cut, any reference information that we felt needed to be fact-checked or added to or taken away. So just so we would have this really clear picture, because it's such a massive book, we wanted to know exactly what we were going to do before we started.
So then, all told, you did end up touching or revising in some way all 4,000 or even more than 4,000 recipes?
Yeah, no. I mean, not a single portion, recipe, you know, section in that book was left untouched. I mean, we really, really tried to, you know, kind of in the tradition that Irma and Marion revised the book, we really wanted to just make everything better. You know, it sounds like a super simple ethos, but in practice, very, very hard.
Also, because didn't you do this in your home kitchen or in a home kitchen as opposed to, like, you know, a school-sized kitchen or a major industrial
right. Yeah,
site?
Absolutely. I mean, we started testing so we were living near John's dad to do this apprenticeship initially, and so we were living in this cabin in rural East Tennessee, and we didn't have a dishwasher at home, which that was interesting. Then we eventually moved to Portland, Oregon, and lived in a couple apartments with really tiny kitchens, and finally were able to buy a house. But we have what we call a two-butt kitchen, so really just the two of us can fit in there comfortably. And honestly, sometimes I get really territorial in the kitchen, so if I'm testing recipes, I need to be there by myself, so I have plenty of space.
I can corroborate that.
And John, you brought up Irma and Marion. And of course, Irma Rombauer is the original author. Marion Rombauer Becker is her daughter. And then this book is the revision of the book has actually been done by a descendant of the original author all the way through?
That's right, yes. Ethan took over. Ethan, my father, yes. He took over after Marion passed away in 1976. And so he oversaw the 1997 edition as well as the 2006 edition. So, yeah, all nine editions have had, more than a little bit of input from the family. I think for this edition, we really wanted to take it back to, you know, as Megan said, we tested all of these recipes out of our home, or, you know, at the end, we were kind of facing a deadline. And so we actually did bring in a few part-time recipe testers that we knew to help with the backlog because, it was getting a little close to the deadline. But, we really wanted to take it back to the 1970s editions that Marion did and Irma before her, where, you know, it was all basically done in-house. The last two editions that Ethan oversaw, there was a test kitchen involved, like you were talking about, you know, which is, a pretty reasonable approach considering how many recipes there are. But we had noticed that there was, you know, kind of a communications breakdown that took place. We inherited all of the test notes from that test kitchen. And so we could kind of see where some things might have gone a little wrong. And we wanted to just make sure that this was kind of harkening back to our best-selling and best-loved editions.
So can you give us an example of like a fixture or an old favorite that you realized you had to revise?
Well, the chocolate chip cookie recipe that you mentioned earlier, which has been in the book since the 40s, I believe, or maybe even
1943. Yeah, there's a head note in it, and it's where Irma is like, there are these newfangled chocolate morsels that are designed to be added to cookie dough.
But we tested that recipe and found we were having kind of inconsistent results. So sometimes they turned out perfectly, and other times they would spread too much and get too thin. And so we really tried to dial in what was going on. And I think, you know, we didn't want to change the recipe too much because people have loved it for a really long time, but we wanted to make sure it came out well no matter who tried it. So we ended up, I think, reducing the brown sugar by like 2 tablespoons and then recommending that you use a dark cookie pan and a cookie sheet instead of a light one because it really makes a difference with how the cookies spread during baking.
We're talking with the authors of the newest edition of Joy of Cooking, who also happen to be family of the original author. John Becker is the great-grandson of Irma Rombauer, who wrote the first 1931 edition of Joy of Cooking, and Megan Scott is his spouse. They've added 600 new recipes, thousands of updates. They've even messed with the chocolate chip cookie one.
Very, very carefully.
Very, very carefully. And made many updates to better reflect the way people cook today. And I want to open the phone lines early. We want to know what you want to ask or tell our guests about your memories of Joy of Cooking, your favorite recipes, what edition you might have, if you've kept older ones, and why. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Now, Megan Scott, you added these recipes also as a way to better reflect the way people cook today. So what does that mean?
We were trying to think about not only, you know, what kinds of specific recipes are people interested in, but what ingredients are available at grocery stores now that even 10 years ago were not. So one example of that is Greek yogurt. 10 years ago in the 2006 edition, Greek yogurt was not called for in any recipe in Joy of Cooking. And in fact, you know, we told people, like, if you want Greek style yogurt, you have to take regular yogurt and strain it. Whereas now you can find, you know, kind of, it seems like infinitely many types of Greek yogurt available at any grocery store. So even things as simple as that have changed over the past 10 years. And we really wanted to speak to that in the new recipes and reference material in the book.
And of course, that extends to so many different ingredients just the varieties of miso that you can find nowadays and we were talking about Samjang.
I haven't tried your recipe for it yet.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a little skeptical, I'll be totally honest.
We enjoy it.
But you stand by your Samjang.
Yes.
Yeah, no, for sure. But, you know, talking about like all of the, you know, new kind of Korean pantry ingredients that you can find, you know, even at our local, the local equivalent would be Ralph's. But yeah, you know, just there's so many things to talk about now that were not available. That was actually pretty much our, at least my favorite part was researching the Know Your Ingredients chapter, which is kind of an alphabetical compendium of ingredients that don't fit under the vegetables and fruits and categories. I mean, we have our special chapters for those that are organized alphabetically, and of course just going to the farmers markets and in the Pacific Northwest, it was hard not to talk about all of the awesome new varieties of produce, or maybe new to us varieties of produce.
Yeah. Well, given how broad people's palates are, mm-hmm. And just how diverse the U.S. is, I mean, how did you do sort of global palates justice in your book? Or do you still worry that you couldn't?
Oh, it's a constant worry. I mean, we're just two people. So, it's impossible for us to really, do justice to such a wide variety of cultural influences and culinary traditions. But, we tried to approach the task respectfully, and we tried to do the best job that we could to make Joy of Cooking more representative of where we're at right now.
Would you say that Korean food is American food?
Absolutely.
I don't know if I would say Korean food is American food. I mean, I think the melting pot idea, I don't necessarily agree with that analogy, because to me it's more like there are these many different cultures in America that remain distinct and have their own personalities, their own traditions. But they do certainly fall within, I think, the umbrella of American cuisine, I would say absolutely.
So fascinating. Well, let me go next to Rosie in Berkeley. Rosie, join the conversation.
Hey, hi, guys. I love this story. I'm curious to know what your response and incorporation is to veganism and vegetarianism, as they've become so much more prevalent than they were in the 1930s. And I will take that off mine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Rosie.
You. Yeah, that's a great question. So we did actually add quite a few new vegan and vegetarian recipes. We have, in the entertaining and menus chapter, we have lists of all the vegetarian or most of the vegetarian recipes and most of the vegan recipes, so you can find them really easily. But we know that people, even if you're not vegetarian or vegan, are trying to eat more plant-based meals or just making meat kind of a smaller part of the plate. So we certainly wanted to speak to that. And also just the way vegetable cookery has changed. In recent years, I think, there was a period in the early, early to mid 1900s or even into the 70s where every vegetable was kind of overcooked by default. And then there was kind of a backlash to that in the 80s and 90s, and everything had to be crisp tender. And now we're sort of discovering all these really awesome ways that you can cook vegetables and, like roasting them or searing them, kind of making them a little more interesting. So we wanted to really reflect the way that vegetable cookery has changed in America too.
Well, given that it's the holidays, I want to ask you about your vegan eggnog, which mm-hmm. of course sounds like an oxymoron.
Yes. I mean, it kind of is, I guess.
Well, even skeptics, it does have a fair amount of liquor in there to, keep everybody happy.
Which in many ways was sort of the overarching, principle or guide for Irma, right, was just to make cooking joyful and to make it not this sort of removed scientific process, but mm-hmm. but her voice in the book was to be kind of your friend helping you along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, we it's not a voice that we felt like we could mimic. So hopefully our voices come through in the book and are just as we hope just as friendly as Irma's. But yeah, no, I think that the common thread there is trying to make cooking less imposing or less anxiety producing to kind of deprofessionalize it instead of coming at it from a professional's perspective and then translating that for home cooks. I mean, this is a book written. I mean, we're knowledgeable, but we're still amateur cooks. Most people's perspectives, I think. We're like, what did you say?
I said we're professional home cooks.
Yeah, we're not chefs. We're not trying to, scale down a bunch of, restaurant originated recipes or something. We really do want to, kind of be there for the home cook.
Yeah. Yeah. And just getting back to the vegan eggnog, I should just ask for our listeners.
Sorry.
No, really quick, how you – I don't want to say replace, but how you created that eggnog effect without
– Sure. I mean, obviously there's no eggs in the nog, but we basically take a can of full-fat coconut milk and combine it with soaked cashews and then plenty of booze. I believe in that one there's Grand Marnier and rum.
Yeah.
And then – garnish it with nutmeg. It's really a simple recipe, but it's really rich and delicious. And I think it fills that void for folks who either, you know, are vegan or they just can't have dairy or perhaps eggs.
And I'm being told that we have the recipe for vegan eggnog on our Twitter feed. You can check it out at KQED Forum. Let me go next to Wanda in Palo Alto. Hi, Wanda.
Hello. As the book has been through many, many more editions, I still love my 1964 because there's so much chatting about the cooking, about the serving, tales about the foods themselves. I'm looking here at wild greens. They list dandelion, Taraxacum officinale, sorrel, Arumex acetosella, wintercress, or Barberia vulgaris. About tossed salads, we hesitate to admit how often we follow the injunction, serve with a tossed salad. The resigned acceptance of ready-made salad dressing has deprived many of us of a treasured prerogative, the making of the French dressing at table. Presiding over cruets, seasonings, and greens was not so long ago a ceremonial privilege of the host or hostess. If the host officiated, it was apt to have a markedly meticulous and conversational quality. Methods of mixing the dressing varied with individual taste, but there was no question of the importance of the moment or of its dignity.
Well, Wanda, thank you for giving us a taste of the voice in the book, especially the voice of 1964. And we're getting some other comments about earlier editions that I'd love to share. For example, Colin tweets, we have 1964 and 1997 editions. The earlier edition includes recipes for squirrel and possum I have yet to try. We consider both indispensable. This listener writes, I love the supposedly obsolete bits in our old copy, game aspics, convalescent foods, and hope that very old editions will be kept in print, at least electronically, even as updates are released. History is fun. In many ways, they are a historical record, right? I was mentioning that, you know, earlier editions were talking about how you incorporate foods from the freezer and use blenders and things like that. And they really kind of also show the changing times with, you know, wartime rationing and things like that. Do you think that that's what's made Joy of Cooking endure? I mean, it's so different from so many cookbooks of our age right now, which have sumptuous photos. They're done by celebrity chefs. We have – you can go online for any recipe or go to YouTube for an instructional video. I mean, your book is like plain black and white, small print, no photos, some drawings. It's like almost encyclopedic in its feel. So how does it compete?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, where does Joy of Cooking fit into the marketplace is a great question. And, you know, I think that, you know, the way that we view it in relationship to all of these, you know, photography heavy, specialized single subject titles or, you know, chef based titles, you know, we're there to fill in the gaps. You know, a lot of these books, they just, well, they're written on a much shorter timeline. They are have a, you know, a much shorter, you know, kind of trend focused outlook on things. And, you know, we publish every 10 years. So we're trying to, you know, find, threads of continuity over time rather than necessarily like the hottest trend on the block right at that second. But
and I think that has really been the legacy of Joy of Cooking. And one of the things that I love so much about it is that, you know, there are people behind the book. There are real humans, but there's not a personality behind the book. It's not – there's no celebrity behind the book. And so I think that has enabled home cooks over four generations to really kind of adopt the book into their family, and it almost becomes like part of the family. The way people pass the book down to their children and grandchildren is really amazing. And that's something that you don't necessarily see with a lot of other cookbooks. So I think that the lack of personality behind the book, and the fact that, you know, Joy of Cooking has always been this really lovely kitchen companion that sort of talks with you and not at you is what has made it so endearing.
And also, you know, we really are geared towards multiple skill levels. You know, we're there for beginner cooks who need to have like a primer on the techniques and the ingredients that they're going to be using in the kitchen. We're there for people who, you know, for seasoned cooks who need a refresher on, how to get the best rise out of a souffle, or even, you know, who find an ingredient that they're puzzled by at the grocery store. We really try to be like, you know, we view ourselves as a supplement to all of the different recipe sources now available either online or, you know, other all of the other fabulous titles that are on the market. I mean, yeah, it's just not something that you're going to get from a Google search, you know, where, you know, the results are, you know, dictated by SEO, by popularity, by number of clicks. You know, we're out there to find the best and information we possibly can and to curate that for our readers.
Well, let me invite Mira to join the conversation. Hi, Mira.
Hi, and it's so interesting. I think you nearly answered the question I was calling with, but I received my joy of cooking as a wedding gift, and I was thinking with this new version, it might be something I'd like to get for my millennial children. But my question was, you know, how do I convince them, or what do I say to them? Use this, you know, because they Google everything.
Well, Megan Scott.
But you were just talking about that.
Yeah. Well, Megan Scott, you are a millennial.
Yes,
right?
I am a millennial.
Do you qualify as a millennial, John?
I've been told that I am like, I'm on the cusp.
Yes.
So apparently I'm an Oregon Trail generation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely played Oregon Trail on the Apple IIe in first grade in the computer room. So.
Yeah.
I would say as someone, I'm a book person, so I'm a little bit biased. But I will say that during this revision process, you know, of course we were using the internet to do part of our research. But one of the things that we found that was really interesting and kind of made me scratch my head is that, you know, we would do this research and try to find the answers to questions or information about ingredients. And what we found was that a lot of bad or incomplete information is repeated ad nauseum online. So one person will say something, then another person will cite that person, and it goes on and on and on. So often, you know, we were trying to find primary sources for our information so that we weren't just repeating bad information. And so I really think that if you – and someone recently said this about the new edition of Joy of Cooking, that they were researching an ingredient, and what they found in our book was more complete information than what they found on the internet, and we cite sources. So I don't know if – kids these days are into that, but I hope they are.
We're talking with Megan Scott and John Becker, co-author of The Joy of Cooking 2019 edition. And we're asking you, our listeners, to share with us your questions for our guests about Joy of Cooking, your favorite recipes or memories of using Joy of Cooking. What additions do you have? Why you've kept older ones or why not, and even if you have some ideas for holiday fare. We're doing it all here at 866-733-6786. That's the number to call to reach Forum, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're bringing some joy into our final segment, Joy of Cooking, that is. The nearly 90-year-old classic cookbook has been revised by the late author Irma Rombauer's great-grandson, John Becker, and his spouse, Megan Scott. They've added 600 new recipes and made thousands of updates to embrace today's dietary trends and global palates, they say, while at the same time, they've tried to remain true to Joy of Cooking's essence. We're also hearing from you, our listeners, about your favorite Joy of Cooking recipes and memories and anything else you want to tell us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also post your comments online and email us at forum@kqed.org. Let me start with Kate in San Francisco. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. I love the Joy of Cooking, and I just wanted to say that I'm the third generation of my family to sort of live with and love the Joy of Cooking. So my grandmother had it, and then my parents had it. And in our family, when you talked about not knowing what to do about some kind of food or how to cook something, what we would say was ask Mrs. Rombauer. meaning go to the book and look it up in the book. And Mrs. Rombauer always knew. So I have my grandparents' edition and my mom's edition, and then I have one that I got at some point, and then my partner has two, one from his parents and one from his own purchase. And among them, we always find what we need, because we go back to the stuff about how to, you know, like the parts of the cow they go together. And I have had squirrel cooked from the recipe.
Oh, nice.
In that book. So
awesome.
Yeah. Well, so from a long time ago, my parents made it. So anyway, I just wanted to say thanks. And we still ask Mrs. Rombauer very frequently in our house.
Oh, well, Kate, thanks for sharing that story. Megan Scott, you were saying that there isn't a personality or celebrity associated with Joy of Cooking, but it sounds like Mrs. Rombauer managed to make it into
at least
the lexicon for Kate's family.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, well, I think Irma was never, you know, she was never on television. And I think there was only one, she only did one radio interview. So she wasn't, you know, known as a personality, but she certainly put her personality in the book. And that's what so many readers love about it.
And John, yeah.
Yeah, same with Marion. Marion was kind of reclusive, but, you know, she definitely, you know, a lot of her personality really does shine through in the book. I guess it was, you know, it's not like the book has no personality. It's just it's not personality driven.
Right. That's so true. I feel like it's a good moment to just ask you, John, if you could share a little bit about what inspired the book, because it was actually quite... It was actually quite tragic for Irma.
No, yeah. It's definitely kind of, I wouldn't say ironic, but yeah, just kind of a strange story to have a book that's called The Joy of Cooking coming out of such tragic circumstances. But Irma, you know, her generation, women of her generation were not, you know, did not really have very much professional training. It was not expected of them. Irma did not go to college. She learned music, you know, the arts, you know, something that, you know,
sort of a high society.
High
woman.
Society, upper middle class.
I think she
lady.
Called it an intellectual patina. Those were her words.
That's nice. Yeah. I didn't remember that. You know, she had had Marion and Edgar Jr., her brother, and then they had moved out. And then her husband, Edgar, had contracted a terminal illness, a cancer. You know, obviously they did not have ways to treat that kind of thing back then, and the treatments that they did have were, you know, really, really bad, painful, and also he had suffered from some sort of mental illness that was, you know, undiagnosed at the time. And so when Irma was in her 50s, Edgar committed suicide. Apparently in as respectful a way as possible, I guess he had called a family member to make sure that, you know, they came to, you know, the house before before Irma. And very tragic.
And he essentially left them destitute, basically.
Yeah, she was left about a year's salary at that time. And so, you know, without any professional skills to fall back on, she came up with the, you know, really kind of crazy idea that she was going to self-publish this cookbook, you know. And while Irma was known as an enthusiastic entertainer, she was not really known for her prowess in the kitchen. I think that even, an acquaintance at the time was reported like, she's doing what? She's not a good cook. But she solicited a lot of recipes from friends and the community, and then put it together and then self-published it, had it privately printed, and then hand-sold it to friends and family who were more than happy to help her out. And, you know, since she was in such dire circumstances, and she would also go into the bookstores and hand-sell it to them and be like, you know, would you sell this book? And eventually it got the attention of Bob's Merrill, a big Midwestern publisher at the time, which led to the 1936 edition. And that, you know, was actually increased the number of recipes in the original was pretty modest. It was, you know, maybe 300 to 400 recipes. Second edition, I think the copy on the dust jacket claims that it has 2,500 recipes in it. So it really was like this big jump. And then also it was written in this really novel recipe format where the ingredients and the directions are mixed in together, kind of like a story. So, you know, instead of calling for, you know, all of the ingredients in one big block, you know, a big list at the beginning, you know, just be like, you know, heat a skillet over moderate heat, you know, add 2 tablespoons of butter, you know, and so like all, it was really easy.
So the ingredients are introduced as you
You use them, right? So it's really easy to follow in the kitchen. You know, it's not as easy to make a grocery list from. I mean, you actually have to read the recipe through before you go to the grocery store, unfortunately.
But you should be doing that anyway.
Yeah.
Well, let me invite Gabby to join us. Gabby in Oakland.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to just thank, you know, the whole family behind the book, because I received a copy of the 1964 edition when I moved into my own place from my mom. And since then, I looked up everything in college, starting with how to boil corn to the first time we hosted Thanksgiving, you know, where to put the forks. And my kids know they're going to get a copy tabbed with the recipes that have been part of our family traditions. For 15 years, I've been making the German honey bars that were in the 1964 edition to use for a gingerbread house or for Oktoberfest. But I understand that it was replaced with a probably more authentic version in the more recent editions. Anyway, I just wanted to thank the family for the traditions, because we've had an annual holiday party that features these gingerbread cookies and for years and years. And the smell of that particular recipe will always mean holidays for me.
Gabby, thank you.
Yeah, the Lebkuchen recipe did – we actually did make some improvements to that this time around as well. There were a few other recipes in the last 2 editions. But yeah, I think that the formula we have now is really, really good.
Well, so Joan mentions it too here. She writes, my childhood memories include my mother doing large-scale holiday baking, and most of the recipes came from Joy of Cooking. She was especially famous for her brownies and my personal favorite, Lebkuchen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Joan asks, are there reprints available of the 1950s Joy of Cooking? I'd like to give her a copy.
No, unfortunately not. But, you know,
you should be able to find them pretty easily at bookstores that have used books. There were a lot of copies printed. So I think, you know, we often find them in used bookstores, and they're usually pretty affordable.
Well, yeah, there's a copy at Omnivore Books right now, I know. And you can also find them at abebooks.com. That's the best resource I have found, at least, for finding used copies of vintage copies of The Joy of Cooking.
Well, Sam writes, the deluxe butter pastry crust is dank. I made it for an apple pie on Thanksgiving.
Dank is probably one of the better compliments we could receive.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
And let me go to Jacob in Berkeley. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just wondering, in this newest edition, how much you all are focusing on sort of the sourcing of the ingredients that are being used in your recipes, where people might be getting these ingredients from, whether or not they should be organic, whether they should be local, the seasonality of the ingredients.
Jacob, thanks.
We certainly do address that, not so much in the recipes themselves, unless, for example, there's a hard-to-find ingredient. We might give a suggestion for where you can find it. But we do talk about sourcing in the reference material. And so we mostly cover the differences between, you know, for example, organic, non-GMO, what does kosher poultry mean versus halal poultry. And we do talk about quality and, you know, when you're sourcing things, especially like meat and seafood, how it's important to have a really good source for those things. And, you know, we try to kind of in the same arena, we try to talk about and address sustainability and how that affects, you know, what you're going to see at the seafood counter, like maybe how you should make meat a smaller part of your plate. And that's something that Joy has actually been talking about since the 60s and 70s. Marion Rombauer Becker was really passionate about health and also kind of making meat a smaller part of the plate and choosing more sustainable options like beans and grains and things like that.
Well, Maria writes, I used to own a 1962 edition of The Joy of Cooking that contained a recipe for whale. I understand why that recipe was removed from later editions of The Joy of Cooking, but I'm wondering what year that happened.
Yeah, that was the 1963 edition, and it's pretty hilarious. That was at the end of the fish chapter, and the head note was last but vast. I feel like they added the whale recipe just, or Marianne added the whale recipe just so she could make a quip in the head note. I don't know. You know, she was, as a previous caller mentioned, you know, there's the squirrel recipe and the 1963. Like the game chapter of that edition is by far the most extensive. Some people, including journalists, thought that some of those game recipes went back to earlier editions because, you know, olden times and whatnot. But actually, it was Marianne trying to make it to make Joy like the most complete culinary reference she possibly could. Irma, I don't think would have anything to do with squirrel. she was way too classy.
Again, we're talking with John Becker and Megan Scott, co-authors of Joy of Cooking, the 2019 edition. And actually, I should tell you where you can see them in the Bay Area. They're going to be at Rake Straw Books in Danville tonight at 7 p.m. and Left Bank Brasserie in Larkspur on Saturday at 12:30 p.m. And the tickets for Saturday include a meal and a book as well. So you can catch them there or you can talk to them now. The number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Next, we go to Lucinda in Sausalito. Hi, Lucinda.
Hey, good morning. So I received my 1997 Joy of Cooking as a Christmas gift from my friend Susan in St. Thomas, and it's my go-to cookbook out of all my cookbooks. So my question to you is, as we're in the holiday season eating, putting on a few extra pounds, I can't help but wonder how much weight you gain by eating all of these recipes.
Thanks, Lucinda.
That's a good question. But one thing that I've personally found is that cooking is a lot of work. And cooking, you know, developing 600 new recipes and testing thousands of old recipes is a lot of work. There was one period during this revision where we were going to the grocery store nearly every day. So running around, doing lots of errands, doing lots of dishes. I also, for whatever crazy reason, took up running during this revision, I think just to take my mind off of the book. John, do you have anything to add to that?
Just that, you know, with a sedentary lifestyle of like basically being at a laptop all the time, it was definitely difficult.
Did you feel pressure, John, to take the mantle? I mean, did your dad Ethan sit you down and say, John, this book has been a family affair since Irma? And we need you as, I mean, you're an only child, is that right?
Yeah, no, I'm an only, so it was me or no one else. Ethan, my father, had, a really rough time with his stewardship of the book, especially during the 1980s. He had a difficult relationship with the publisher at the time and was actually trying to publish a new edition in the 1980s and, you know, was working with a whole host of contributors and collaborators. And that, you know, the publisher at the time just was having none of it. They really wanted to kind of edge the family out of the editorial – on the editorial side. They wanted to kind of have, you know, just treat Joy of Cooking as another property, another brand, which they could, you know, do with as they see fit. And so – you know, I think that, his experiences with the publisher and also, you know, just the hectic nature of, putting together the 1997 edition, all of those things combined, I think, to, you know, where he was just basically like, you really just need to follow whatever you want to do. You know, just wherever life takes you, that's what you should do. He always said that the book was there for me if I wanted it. But, for a long time, I really was trying to just, I went to school for, got an undergrad in literature and, you know, was halfway thinking about teaching, had actually, you know, helped a former professor and mentor, you know, publish multiple books, 17 in all. And, during that time, I was really developing a lot of the skills that would come in handy, for doing this revision. I wasn't until I had never read the dedication to the 1963 edition. It's funny how many times that edition is getting mentioned because it really is like our North Star, like that in the 1975 for this current revision. It's just what Marianne did with the book was fantastic. But I had never read the dedication to it. And, one night when I was really having trouble figuring out what I was going to be doing next, you know, what I encountered it like late at night when I was visiting my dad, everybody else was asleep. It was Christmas. And So Marianne had written this dedication. It was the first solo edition that she had done. And so the dedication had, you know, a really nice heartfelt, you know, farewell to Irma. And then the very last part of it was, you know, kind of addressed to Ethan and future generations. And it was the line that really got me was, I hope that my sons and their wives continue to keep Joy a family affair, beholden to no one but themselves and you, you being the reader. You kind of felt like, I don't know, just I felt not only implicated, but also almost liberated. It was a really weird confluence of emotions. But in the end, I feel like just that night and encountering that particular quote really changed the direction of my life and for the better. It's been really fantastic working on this book. And I feel like, you know, I was never able to meet Marianne, and obviously I was never able to meet Irma. But just through this process, I feel like I know them on a really meaningful level.
And yeah. It clearly sounds like our listeners feel similarly as they encounter the book. Well, let me turn now to Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan. Join us.
Good morning. What a delightful segment. Thank you, everybody. I will sorely miss my Joy of Cooking edition from the 1953-54 era, I believe, because of the potato chip ingredients that were in so many recipes, which I loved. But it was but we lost our family home in the Tubbs Fire in Calistoga a couple of years ago. And the first thing that happened that I couldn't get over was our neighbors, many of whom were also impacted, gave me a cookbook to replace the books we'd lost. And it was The Joy of Cooking from 1963. And they signed their names on the cover. And it means the world to me that that's what they thought I would most love. And it especially meant something because of the Rombauer Winery, which, you know, was, I think, an offshoot of the family. I may have missed you talking about that earlier. And the Joy of Cooking display in St. Helena, the books that are there at the Culinary Institute. So it feels like the book has a wonderful footprint in that area, and I'm very grateful that I got a copy from really beloved neighbors in the Calistoga area.
No, we really appreciate the family that we have in St. Helena. They've been fantastic to us. You know, we go down there every year, at least either the two of us or my father, Ethan, we go down there for the Chardonnay release party. And they're just fantastic.
It's people. A great Chardonnay.
Yeah, no, it's a crowd pleaser for sure.
Yeah. Well, this listener writes, I moved to San Francisco in 1973 at 22. I bought Joy of Cooking that first year. It was my Bible. I ended up cooking in restaurants for 17 years, self-taught, in a time when women weren't in restaurant kitchens very much. Joy of Cooking played a large part in spurring my passion and enthusiasm for learning and cooking more. Kate writes, I got my first and only copy of Joy in 1976 when I got married. Simply put, it taught me how to cook. The book is now full of tomato splatters, grease spots, blood stains, and a lovely spray of quince jam over several pages in the jams and preserves section. Mirvaja tweets, for people who don't drink alcohol, can they simply omit the alcohol in the vegan eggnog recipe?
Yes, you absolutely could do that. I'm trying to think if you should add something else, maybe add some spices to make it a little more interesting. But certainly you could omit the alcohol.
Well, then there's also those non-alcoholic spirits that are being sold. You know, there might be one of those that would work well.
Possibly.
Like I think it's called seed lip.
Yeah, something to try out for
Not
sure.
Not to add to your list. Denise writes, how did they change the chocolate chip recipe? I think it's almost perfect, but I do double the amount of chocolate chips. So tell Denise how you changed that recipe.
We changed it only very slightly, and we really didn't want to change it at all, but we kept getting reports that some folks were having trouble with the cookies spreading too much and getting too thin, which, you know, some people really like that, others don't. So it's kind of in the eye of the beholder. But we reduced the brown sugar, I think, from a third of a cup. I'm trying to remember if it was half a cup to a third of a cup, you know, by about 2 tablespoons. And then we just recommend people bake them on a dark baking sheet. So that's really the only change to the recipe. Otherwise, we kept it exactly the same.
Well, speaking of sugar, Mary Ellen asks, I've used the Devil's Food Cake recipe for years. Will new cake recipes include some that are less sweet and use less sugar?
We didn't develop recipes specifically to be low sugar. It was more, you know, what we think tastes good. You know, Joy of Cooking has always been a book that doesn't try to prescribe what people or how people cook, just rather to teach them how to make things. And so I think you could certainly adapt many of the recipes to use less sugar without too many ill effects. You know, I think you could probably reduce the sugar by a third in most recipes. most of the cake recipes without it, impacting the quality. But we didn't really develop recipes specifically for low sugar cakes.
When our foreign producer, Ariana Prale, asked the publisher for examples of recipes to highlight, they sent us latkes. So I'm wondering.
That's interesting.
Oh, really? What was special about this one that they thought you might want to talk about it?
Huh. I'm not sure. I mean, we did revise the recipe in this. It's been in the book for quite a while. It's certainly not a new recipe. We did revise it to make a larger quantity because I think our quantity before was not nearly enough. I mean, there's never enough latkes. But yeah, I'm not sure why they sent that one over, honestly.
No, I mean, there's plenty of recipes to highlight. That is an odd one.
But you did also expand your Jewish foods in Joy Cooking for this edition.
That's true.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we added a we added a new kugel recipe,
a potato kugel. Yes.
I think that we added like another version of Haroset.
Yes. Yeah, Herosis. And then we added, you know, perhaps not as well known, but a sandwich called Sabich, which is an Iraqi Jewish sandwich that is amazing.
Yeah, definitely one of my favorite sandwiches. so good. Knishes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Knish.
Well, let me bring Sohana from Redwood City in. Am I saying your name correctly?
Yes.
What would you like to say?
I have my grandma's copy of The Joy of Cooking from the 1950s, and as a vegetarian, it might not be the best choice of cookbook, but she has perfected so many recipes by just adding notes in the margin of different ways to make, especially the breakfast dishes and the pies, that I would not throw that away for anything.
Well, Sohana, thanks. And we have heard from several listeners who've said that their copies, they keep because of the handwritten notes in the margins or because of the little slips of paper that are, you know, inside the book that they discover. And it really reminds them of family.
Now, the marginalia that we see in the used copies really, you know, it makes our hearts go pitter patter. Really touching. And, you know, like the earlier, I guess it was a tweet that you were reading just about, you know, splattered copies. I mean, yeah, when we see pristine copies, I mean, that's its own special thing. But, you know, the splattered, abused, well-loved ones are our favorites, for sure.
Well, Derek writes, spicy Sichuan noodles are my family's favorite Joy of Cooking dish, one we make and serve on an almost weekly basis, including last night. We find it by looking for the soy sauce stains. Tommy in Menlo Park join us. Hi, Tommy.
Hey, Hi. Good morning, everyone.
Hey.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
It's funny how the well-worn copies, my mother's copy, probably from the 40s, is like the sought-after family heirloom with all the index cards of other family recipes stuck in there. And, you know, everybody wants that book. But when I was like 6 or 7 years old, my mother was gone for some reason, and I looked in the cookbook. I was fascinated by her always looking while she was cooking, and I found recipe for candy, and I thought, wow. And I looked in the cupboard. I found enough stuff to make taffy, and in the process burned my hand and made a mess in the kitchen, got in big trouble with my mother. That was my first experience with Irma Brombeck. But also, I wanted to ask you, I remember later in life looking and finding the rendered fat and lard as a large and a lot of recipes. And I'm wondering if you guys left that in there or you deleted that.
Yeah, what did you do with fat? Thank you, Tommy.
Oh, no. We increased our coverage of lard as an ingredient. And also, we talk specifically about schmaltz in the Know Your Ingredients chapter as well. We talk about doing both what is called wet rendering and dry rendering. We're on board with animal fats. The Know Your Ingredients chapter has a lot, and it was definitely one of the most fun things to put together.
I will say we probably use lard less in the recipes themselves than perhaps in the 50s, but we tried to provide more context for how, you know, if you want to make it yourself, render it yourself, and, you know, how it can be used. And when it's appropriate, we do call for it.
So we just have a couple minutes left, but as I'm hearing people share their memories surrounding the book, did I read right? Megan Scott that the reason the two of you met was because John randomly heard you talking about Joy of Cooking?
Oh, no, actually. So I bought Joy of Cooking for myself. It was my first cookbook purchase, and I loved the book. I was working at a bakery talking with a coworker about Joy of Cooking, and he said, "Didn't you know that the guy who wrote whose family wrote Joy of Cooking works at that coffee shop down the street?" And I did not, and I thought that couldn't be correct. So after my shift, I went down to the coffee shop, asked the barista about it, and it happened to be John who was working, and he turned beet red and said, "Yes, that's my family." Kind of, he looked kind of guilty, and I was so excited. And so we ended up talking more, and I asked him out on a date, and we hit it off, and that's how we met.
Yeah, now Megan had been coming in for a long time, and in fact, she would bring these cheddar scallion biscuits from her bakery to share with everybody that was working. And you know, we didn't know her name, but you know, she became known as the cheddar scallion biscuit girl, and. You know, like I remember a coworker was like, "Oh, you should ask her out." And I was like, "No, she's out of my league." But
So Joy of Cooking was not the common way that you got dates, John Becker.
No.
So leave us with any final thoughts for your devoted fan base and for new people to Joy of Cooking that you'd like to leave them with in terms of what you'd like the impact of this edition to be.
We've spent a really long time trying to make this book better, and we hope that we have done so in a way that, you know, everybody that who has loved the older editions will continue to, you know, cherish. And
we also hope readers will continue to use this new edition for decades to come.
Megan Scott and John Becker, co-authors of Joy of Cooking 2019, so appreciate having you both come in and be on the show today.
It was so great to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for your memories, your suggestions, your recipes. We hope you have a very savory weekend. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.